You are listening to Losing Myself, Mental Health in a Hostile Environment, a podcast brought to you by Migrants Organise. Throughout this series, we hope to shine a light on the realities of the UK's immigration and asylum system, explore the pressure and anguish it puts upon people who go through it, while also hearing about hopeful and powerful acts of migrant and community organising. Each episode will focus on a different aspect of the UK's asylum system. On today's episode, I am joined by Angeliki and Kasun from the Helen Bamber Foundation. The Helen Bamber Foundation is a human rights charity giving survivors of torture and trafficking the strength to move on through therapy, legal protection, medical advice, housing, help with integration, and other services. We talked about the intricate and complex web that makes up NHS mental health care and how easy it is for vulnerable people fleeing trauma and cruelty to fall through the cracks as they are moved around the country, face language barriers, or encounter services that struggle to build a sense of trust and safety. We chatted about the different ways of understanding mental health around the world and some ideas for how practitioners could adapt their services to better meet the needs of refugees and migrants. So today I am joined by Angeliki and Kasun from the Helen Bamber Foundation. How are you both doing?
Doing well, thank you. Hi, Luke.
Doing great, yeah.
Could you both introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about the Helen Bamber Foundation?
Hi, I'm Kasun. I'm a refugee myself. I was a client at Helen Bamber Foundation. Now I'm a mentor helping the photography group. Also, I'm doing some social enterprise organization that is helping refugees to overcome their trauma. And then also I'm working full time.
I'm Angeliki. I'm a clinical psychologist at the Helen Bamber Foundation. The Helen Bamber Foundation, just briefly, it's a human rights organization working with survivors of trauma and human rights abuses. And we're working in supporting them with their various needs, including their mental health needs, which is what I do. Outside of the Helen Bamber Foundation, I've worked in other NHS, in the NHS as well, in mental health services in the NHS, including in trauma specialist teams and also refugee services in the NHS.
Brilliant. Okay, and we'll come back to all of these experiences a little bit more later on. So just to start us off, Kasun, could you briefly talk to us about your connection with the NHS and mental health services in general in the UK?
When I come to this country, and then I didn't know anything about this mental health, and then I was experiencing something strange. And then I was keeping those experiences with me. And then somehow my friend understood that I'm not okay. And they wanted to take to the GP, actually. And then they, from that point only, I got some medication. I was introduced to various mental health services for therapy. And I was also moving because I was with home office, and then the accommodation moves from place to place, and then my.
How did you? So we'll come on to this a little bit later on, but you met Angeliki through the Helen Bamber Foundation's work, right?
I met Angeliki at Helen Bamber Foundation as my doctor for my therapy. It was a nice experience, and then it was like a total different way of therapy. I had the therapy before in NHS as well, but it was not like that much effective. And then the last one I had with Angeliki was like really effective and kind of giving you the start from to start like a new start.
So Kasun, you're somebody who has had experience of mental health services with the NHS and with the Helen Bamber Foundation. What was your understanding about mental health before coming to the UK?
Back home, we don't see this say about mental health. It's kind of like something that you don't want to share with anyone. It's like very personal. If you share about how you feel or your mental health issue, and then they will start thinking about you that maybe you're a crazy person or you're mad, or that just you have like a separate hospitals for that for crazy people when it's severe. there's no that much mental health support back home. And then especially when you're a minority and then you guys were going through some bad experience with the government and the country, and then you don't want to share any mental health issue with others, and then you don't even share this with your doctor, and then you always live with fear. And then in the UK is totally different, and then they just listen to you very carefully and with the compassion and then the support, and then you can open your whatever the experience you're going through, and then they treat you and then I didn't know the word called PTSD. Mm-hmm. And then when I come here only, I heard that there's something just everyone is going through, most of the people going through, and then there's a treatment for that.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Angeliki, is there anything you wanted to add on this point?
Yeah, I was just thinking to add that it's important to consider that it's very often difficult for people who have experienced trauma to discuss it anyway and open up about it. And as it can trigger bad memories, it can trigger this sense of fear and unsafety and relieving that situation. And it can also bring up a lot of feelings of shame for some people about having experiences, about the experiences that they have endured. So if you add to that stigma about mental health, which people from a lot of cultural backgrounds might have internalized, it can make it even harder to open up and talk about mental health difficulties to professionals, to doctors, try to seek out and access that help. And I'm thinking specifically of a lady I saw a few weeks ago for an assessment, and she was really, really terrified to discuss with me any mental health difficulties, because in her mind, doing so would mean that we would be labeling her as crazy, as Kasun said, and that would mean that we would take actions to separate her from her children. And she was so terrified of that, that she was not seeking the support that she needed for her difficulties. And the other thing that Kasun really nicely explained when he talked about PTSD is the not having that mental health language. In the UK, in English, we kind of use the words depression and trauma and triggers and PTSD quite like it's they're quite commonly used among the general public, and there's a lot of awareness about some of these difficulties, especially among younger generations, but that's not necessarily true for other populations, about migrants and asylum seekers that have been raised in other cultural contexts, that they might have had less exposure to this type of language. So it's not uncommon actually for migrants and asylum seekers to present with lots of physical complaints instead. So for example, they could be going to their GPs and be presenting with headaches and stomach problems, or very, very commonly sleep difficulties. And it might take a while even for their doctors to pick up that there are underlying mental health difficulties there. That awareness and that language is very important, often as a first step when we're thinking about treatment and access as well to treatments.
So let's take a step back and maybe just put things in perspective. How does a person get mental health treatment in the UK? So maybe we could talk about what's supposed to happen and what actually happens in practice.
Yeah, so there's actually a quite established and intricate mental health infrastructure in the UK, as Kasun mentioned, but it can also be very complicated, as it's a very huge structure as well. It's a complicated system. So in the NHS, what commonly happens, it's not 100% always the case, but the way that most locations, most trusts work, is that you would be seeing your GP first, and you would be referred to primary mental health services, There you would be screened. You had initial screening and an assessment. And depending on the outcomes of that assessment, that screening, you might be offered some support, some psychological support, medication, or other types of community support. Or in some cases, if difficulties are very severe and it's felt that you need inpatient hospitalization, that might be another outcome. So you might, if you're offered some support in a primary care mental health setting, and after that, that is usually a short intervention. If it's felt that you need more intervention, you might be stepped up to secondary specialist mental health services, or you might be stepped up to that directly if it feels that your needs require some more specialist or some support that is a bit for more complex presentations. The difficulty is that not the same type of specialist services and specialist support exists in different locations, and especially outside of London, it's difficult to find some specialist services. And in reality, the other thing that's difficult is that even though there's such good practice in the NHS mental health services, mental health services are often not, they're often underfunded, or they have like lots of high degrees of staff coming and leaving because of high degrees of burnout, and they don't have the resources to cope with the very high levels of mental health concerns among the general public. And that is like, I think that is increasing at the moment. That's in my opinion, because of many different reasons, including the effects of a pandemic. And, you know, it's often said that there's another pandemic. There's a mental health pandemic at the moment, which is related to lots of the social problems that exist in society, like high levels of poverty and crime, the effects of COVID, high levels of racism, and also lots of systemic injustices. And then you have the third sector organizations like the Helen Bamber Foundation that try to fill the gaps. So there are lots of charities and other third sector organizations that provide counseling support, but there's also some charities like the Helen Bamber Foundation that provide evidence-based treatment for clinical presentations like PTSD. An evidence-based treatment is a treatment that has been shown by research in clinical population to work and to be effective. If you are suffering from a mental health disorder, then there you should be provided access to those kind of research-based, evidence-based interventions for the specific disorder that you're suffering from. So, for example, for PTSD, evidence-based interventions include trauma-focused therapies like trauma-focused CBT and EMDR.
Thank you. Yeah, that is really clarifying. Kasim, so we've been talking about maybe how mental health services are supposed to work and how they actually work in practice. What has been your experience?
I would say sometimes you have to wait for a long time to get an appointment, you know, like just get into the system like that. That maybe taking 3 months, maybe 6 months, sometime more than that to get into the list and then to see a doctor initially. And even when you get into the primary care, like Angeliki was saying, but there are kind of limitation, and then they can only do a certain level, and then they cannot support. It's also depend on your status. And if you're an asylum seeker, you are just limited to get the access to the required treatment. So just you have to just to take the medication, and then you have to go through the primary care or the basic level of treatment. And that is something I was going through until I got my papers as a refugee, and then I could get more treatment or something like that. The other thing is the general problem is the language. So like most of the asylum seekers, they are coming from different part of the world, and then some people, they don't know the language, and then they can't get the support, and then they are under pressure about the the asylum application, and then also they are going through this the PTSD or the depression or anxiety, maybe from their country they fled the war, or they and then they get caught by these traffickers, or like so many reasons. Plus the asylum application process in the UK is just very, very bad. There's also every time you need to go, every month you need to go to report to a reporting center at Home Office. So that place is like a very, very terrible place. So it's gonna make you like feel bad, and then sometimes I see, and then they catch people from that place, and then they deport us. All these things happen, and then every time I want to go to the reporting center, I all these bad memories, and then I relive the situation. And then luckily, I joined Hallenbaum Foundation. They were helping me every single step, and then there are so many of them outside, which they couldn't get the support.
You talked before about being moved around the country when you kind of came here. How did that affect your treatment?
Yes, I was initially I was living with my friend, and then the Home Office they provide asylum seekers accommodation, and then they gave me accommodation in Wales. And then before I'm going to move into Wales, I was going to mental health services in Ealing. So I was seeing like doctors and psychiatrists, and then getting medication and everything. It was just in the beginning. And then the accommodation was moved to Wales, and then I didn't know anyone there. So I didn't know where to go and get my medication. I didn't have anything, and then the contact with the therapist or the psychiatrist just broke down. So I stayed there for a couple of months, and then I was moved to back to London in a different place, different part of the London, and then from there I was seeing another doctor, another psychiatrist, and it was getting delayed, and there was a like a waiting list. It's like, yeah, it was no good experience as a person who's suffering from PTSD or like mental health. It's just you don't see a doctor or a therapist regularly. It's not helping to recover sooner. That's gonna start the process again and again, and then it doesn't work. Didn't work for me actually. Yeah. Like when you are an asylum seeker, when you don't have a state, you know, still you're waiting for a decision. It's like even if you get the service, you know, like to meet the therapist or like a psychiatrist, and then sometimes it's not helping you because you don't know what's going to happen, and then to your application, sometimes are they going to deport to you to the same country you fled, and that you're gonna face prosecution or a death penalty back home. Just in my case, I was fighting against almost 5 years to get my refugee status. So all those 5 years, I was taking medication, going to treatments and seeing therapists, and then seeing psychiatrists. And none of them helped me, and then. The fear about your application is always comes first. Then you help yourself. You overcome the PTSD or something, and then none of them helped me fully until I get my paper, and then I finally had the treatment with Angeliki, and then that. Was helping me because you basically solved the main problem, that is you are refugee and you got the refugee status as to stay in the country, and then you feel safe in the first place, and then you get the treatment or therapy, and then that is effective, and then most of our asylum seekers, they are there in between whether they can, their application going to succeed or not. So what will happen to them? And then what they are going through is not like coming to an end or like it's not like easing them. And then also the problem what she mentioned, and then the amount of fund they get or money for a weekly basis about £30 or £35 those days, and it's not even enough for you to eat, you know. And then you live with in home office accommodation, you live with others, like in a room you live with 10 people or around 8 to 10 people, and then you going through so many issues at night or like daytime. And then it's kind of, I don't know how to explain that. It's not really helping a person who is going through mental health issues. And then again, and the traveling issues. So if you want to go to an appointment and then you don't have enough money, and then they don't know, plus the language barrier, and then you don't know where to get, to whom to speak, and how to get some support on all these things. Just there are, it's kind of a cycle happening again and again with their asylum application. It's just not helping at all until their problem is solved, and then the application is, they get a decision whether it's the application is approved or rejected or something. And then that's, if it is like a person like me, if it is dragging all 5 years, and then imagine how your life is going to be, how the treatment or the medication you're taking is going to help you. It's totally, it's kind of not supporting you as a person who is suffering from mental health.
Well, thank you both for sharing that. So we've talked about some of the difficulties with the reality of the mental health process in the UK. Angeliki, did the difficult process have any impact on you or other clients?
Yeah, what we unfortunately see a lot among asylum seeker and refugee populations is that our clients often struggle a lot to access NHS mental health services. And that is because of a lot of the reasons that we talked about earlier that are kind of like faced by everyone, by the general public, including the, as Kashun said, long waiting lists that are fortunately only getting longer in many services that provide excellent care, but they're understaffed. So that means that you wait for years to get that excellent care, which in that meantime, the difficulties can become more chronic, more entrenched in a way. And the other difficulty is the threshold. Sometimes you might be told by mental health service that your presentation is actually not severe enough, or it is not relevant to us, and it's more related to your practical problems, and you might not be provided that support. Or the opposite. We see a lot referrals that come to us when mental health services NHS mental health services are assessing asylum seeker, and they are deeming that their difficulties are too complex for them to manage, and they refer to us. So it can be difficult. And the other thing to add is to comment on something that Kasun said earlier about what asylum seekers are entitled to. So actually, asylum seekers are entitled to, if they have an active claim, if they're in the system, they should also have access to mental health services, all types of mental health services. But this is something that is it's a common misconception, and a lot of people, a lot of individuals trying to seek it out, but also a lot of professionals, a lot of medics, even GPs are not aware of. So that is another barrier for people accessing the help they need.
Do the issues you've encountered specifically affect the migrant community, or is it a problem for everybody? What additional barriers do migrants and asylum seekers face?
So First of all, it's important to think about how asylum seekers and refugees and migrants in general as well, they are, to start with, they have very high vulnerabilities for mental health difficulties. And that is because people who have fled their countries for reasons for persecution or war or any type of exposure to psychological trauma, then they have more a high likelihood to present with mental health difficulties because of that trauma. But it's also because people, in order to arrive to safe countries, they often have to undergo really dangerous and really difficult journeys that are in themselves traumatizing, and they're in themselves producing a lot of hopelessness, a lot of difficulties for people. And then when they arrive in safe countries, they're often faced with what we call here in the UK, the hostile environment. And they're faced with a lot of post-migration stressors, let's call them, which is sadly the case here as well in the UK. There's a high amount of stressors, as Kasun mentioned, about the difficulty with resolving your asylum claim, and also like difficulties accessing support, accessing the appropriate housing, and having enough food to eat, having access to the basics, things that you need to survive. So that those difficulties can obviously either create or make worse existing mental health problems. So you have like this increased vulnerability for mental health difficulties, and then you have additional barriers than faced by the general public to access services. So as I kind of mentioned earlier, services may not offer support when they consider that issues are situational. So for example, mm-hmm. they might say, oh, this is not a mental health problem, this is because of your asylum status or because of your housing problems. But I kind of disagree with this line of thinking. Mental health and life stressors are not, don't fit in separate neat little boxes. They obviously affect each other, as we all know. If you're stressed about big issues in your life, it would affect your mental health, and it could make worse your already existing mental health problems, and or make it more difficult to cope with them. And also it can trigger reminders, as Kasun said, like if you have to go to report to a home office, that can trigger reminders of experiences of being like persecuted by government forces in your home country, for example. And then there needs to be more kind of holistic thinking. There needs to be more a holistic approach in treatment where you consider all these different aspects of a person's life and how they affect them. And unfortunately, the way that the system is set up is not like in most services, they're not set up like that. Physical health is very separate to mental health provision, local authorities and housing provision, and obviously like the home office and the legal application, they're very separate processes. So it's often very difficult for people to access this kind of like integrated thinking and integrated care. And the other issue around access is something that Kasun like talked about with his example, is that often asylum seekers are moved around a lot, and services are very locality based. So you get a lot of people who have been waiting on a waiting list in a location for a very long time, but then they're moved and they need to kind of start from zero. And you see that unfortunately a lot. I have an example from a mother that I was seeing of a young boy who was presenting with autism, with neurodevelopmental difficulties. It took years and years for him to get assessed and get the diagnosis and the support he needed, because they were moved around so much. Autism assessments were long in every locality. So that meant that they went on a waiting list again and again. And that was lots of missed years of his life, of that little child's life, that he didn't get the support he needed at school. So that can have a real impact on people. Another example was a young girl that I was seeing that she presented with PTSD, but also an eating disorder that was related to the trauma she experienced. And in order for us to feel that it's safe to treat her trauma, we needed for her to treat her eating disorder that was, in a way, could have been life-threatening. And she managed, we referred her successfully, and she managed to access be on a waiting list for a treatment in an eating disorder clinic. But then she was moved by the Home Office to a locality that didn't have eating disorder services. So that meant that she couldn't access that treatment or the trauma treatment, that because that was a prerequisite. And we needed to do a lot of work in advocating that she moves back to that location that she was initially, so she could access the treatment that she needed for her health.
I just wanted to ask you a question about the situational sort of stresses. So this feels like quite a sort of dismissive and arbitrary reason to deny somebody care, to say that, you know, their problems are due to their situation. As we've talked about, it seems very difficult to untangle what's happening in your life with how you feel about it. How are they supposed to apply that criteria, and you know, do they offer any practical help if they say, you know, this is a situational problem, you need to go and get support from someone else?
So I think it's based on an old type of thinking that you first need to have everything stabilized in your life in order to be able to do any type of trauma work, which we actually don't. That's not our ethos at the Helen Bamber Foundation. What usually happens, and that's not, like, I don't want to generalize that to every type of service, but what some services would do is they would say, oh, what you need is access to legal support. What you need is access to support around housing and welfare needs, and before we even think about psychological support. But in reality, there is a lot you can do psychologically as well as people are facing those stressors, because the reality is that those stressors can take ages to resolve. An application, an asylum claim application, unfortunately can take years to be resolved. During those years, you would be probably accessing inappropriate or less than optimal housing. So denying people the treatment that they need during that time is not ethical, in my opinion, but also, like, even if people are not ready to do, like, trauma-focused therapy, that can be really difficult. If people are in unstable circumstances, they might, not necessarily, but they might not be ready for it. But there is psychological support you can offer, like support around developing coping strategies to deal with the stressors and your existing mental health symptoms. And many services do provide that, but we do see a lot of services denying the help based on that criterion, unfortunately.
Yes, I bring that up just because, I mean, throughout a lot of the episodes that we've done, we've talked about the situations people seeking asylum and migrating to the country find themselves in. They don't have very much control over. It's very much just waiting on decisions from the Home Office. So it seems kind of doubly cruel to then say we can't do any of the reconstructive work, we can't do any of the healing work until this kind of arbitrary decision, which, as you said, can take a very, very long time to come through. So I was just really surprised, you know. So thank you for chatting a bit more about that.
I think the other thing that goes into that is that often there is this fear, which is a justified fear among clinicians, that I might start providing an intervention, but something very destabilizing might happen. For example, you might have a refusal to your asylum claim, and then you're in the middle of very difficult trauma work, and something really bad happens and destabilizes everything. So it's not safe to do that. That is a risk. That is a valid risk. And that's why, like, I think one of the difficulties is that because of lack of resources, NHS services are really pushed to be very almost rigid in a way, in the way that they provide treatment in terms of criteria, but also in for example, if you, they might say, if you miss three sessions, we're going to discharge you. People with our population, they miss a lot of appointments. They miss appointments because of their mental health needs, because trauma work is really difficult, and sometimes avoiding it is kind of like a core part of PTSD, actually. But also because they might not have money to travel to the appointments, they might have a lot of practical barriers to accessing that help. So, like the lack of flexibility, clinical flexibility, and kind of like waiting for people to be ready rather than discharging them, like giving them the opportunity to say, okay, it's not the right time for you now, but we're not going to ask you to re-refer in a year and be on another waiting list for another 2 years. We're going to keep you on like an on hold list and see you when you're ready. But that is very difficult to happen in services because of capacity issues. So that is a structural difficulty, and the other structural difficulty is the lack of, often, as Kasun said, like lots of services don't routinely use interpreters. They might not have the cultural competencies. They might not feel capable to work with the demands of this population, and that is not because they don't care, they're not compassionate, but they might be underfunded or unskilled to do that. Often clinical environments can be very sterile. They can be very hospital-like. They can be what we call not very trauma-informed. And they can be actually, for some people, triggering memories of traumatic experiences that they had before they came to this country, so like being in prison or being detained or being tortured. So that is another reason why some people don't want to engage. They don't, even if they do access the support, they might find it very aversive to begin with, so they might not really give it a chance afterwards as well. And that's why it's really important to be thinking about trauma-informed environments when you're working with traumatized population, but also trauma-informed processes in general. I think if you have, for example, if you're doing a screening over the phone with someone, with an interpreter, and you ask them about the trauma they experience, that can be a really aversive conversation and very traumatizing conversation for some people. They don't know who the interpreter is. They might not feel like they trust them. They can't see them. They can't see the clinician. They might be asked questions that they don't feel ready to answer, especially to a stranger. And often what we do see is that people will say to us, yes, I was referred for mental health support. I had this telephone call. It was horrible. I never want to see them again. And even though there's like all these good intentions in offering people the treatment they need, sometimes this kind of like initial, not very trauma-informed processes can trigger people and make it difficult for them to engage with that support.
I had the same kind of experience, and then I had an appointment with the doctor, and then I have a translator, and then she's the lady, and then I didn't want to explain what happened to me in front of a lady, which is a translator, and that kind of hold my everything. I didn't, I couldn't explain what I was really going through. It's kind of very personal to me. And then, like, those kind of issues are there so that you don't want to disclose all the information that is relevant to your treatment. When you have a translator, she's like a lady, and then also at the language barrier. Actually, the translator was totally totally a different language. So there was this a misunderstand.
Fantastic. That's such a good example. So we've talked a bit about kind of practices that maybe should be in place. What training do NHS staff receive when it comes to supporting clients from migrant backgrounds, particularly those who are still fighting for their status?
I think it varies a lot, and it's changing as well. I think there is a bit more of an emphasis in nowadays to have to include more training in this in different types of qualifications, like in psychology, or when you are when you're starting a job at the Mental Health Trust. But I would say that I think there's still kind of like lots of gaps. There's still a very little training across the board when you're thinking about the specific needs of this population, this particular population, asylum seekers and refugees. And often it's up to individual services or individual teams to kind of try to seek out that training rather than that's something that is offered across the board. So what ends up happening is that there's lots of clinicians that feel quite unskilled to manage the specific difficulties of this population. And sadly, what we see as a result is that services would discharge or not provide treatment or refer to the third sector, or as I said earlier, because they don't feel that they can provide that. So I would say that there is need for more training in first in kind of like trauma-informed care and what that looks like. Things like we talked about already, things like what Kasun said about considerations about language, consideration about giving people choice about, for example, the gender of the interpreter, or even like not making an assumption that a person wants an interpreter. I've had a lot of clients whose English is not their first language and they might not be fluent in English yet, but they actually felt more unsafe with an interpreter present. So it's the idea of giving choice, actually, that is the most important thing. But also like training in thinking about the specific vulnerabilities of this population, the impact of those type of post-migration stressors, the things that are going in people's life, if there are asylum claims, for example, and how those experiences and the stresses that come with that can interact with existing mental health difficulties, but also be aware of like the higher risk that people might face. For example, in the current environment, sadly, there is increase of hate crime, there's increase of racism across the board. We've had clients that directly faced very intense racism that obviously further exacerbated their mental health difficulties and made them feel even more unsafe, which they already felt unsafe, but it made it feel even worse. But there's also high risk of exploitation, high risk of trafficking or re-trafficking for those who have been trafficked because of their vulnerabilities, because of their mental health difficulties they present with, but also the lack of opportunities. And then there's the actual risks with that fear of return hanging over you, what that can do to your mental health chronically and how difficult it can make it for you to heal. So what like training in like clinicians would have more, need to have more training and support and supervision around how to help people and develop coping mechanisms within that context, because unfortunately that this is the context, and as we're working hard to change the context, there are things that we can do as mental health practitioners to support people.
Fab. So we've used the term trauma-informed a few times. I thought it might be really useful for the listeners if we just like nailed down exactly what we mean by that.
Yes. So it's a term that is used a lot now in mental health services, and it's kind of like it's not really a new thing, but it's something that there is more emphasis on now. It's kind of like moving away from a very authoritarian medical model where like the doctor is the sole expert and the patient knows nothing, then they're told what to do. So it's kind of like trying to move away from that model to a model of empowering people, giving them choice, giving them, providing them with practical and emotional safety, and also with compassion. And it's not a specific type of intervention. It's not something that only psychologists can do, or like it's something that anyone can do. There's actually lots in Scotland. Scotland is very ahead of England actually on this. They have a really huge program to train people in trauma-informed care that work in the public sectors. So from everyone, from doctors to bus drivers, to be to have those that knowledge and that skill to recognize the signs of trauma, which are unfortunately like there's a massive amount of people among the general population that has experienced traumatic events and in their lives. And it's about learning how to recognize the signs and react in a way that is compassionate and supportive rather than potentially re-traumatizing.
Mm-hmm. Kasun, do you feel like the people who worked with you understood the issues that you were facing, whether that's in terms of immigration or sort of some of the wider barriers that we've talked about?
Like most of the doctors and nurses I meet, they are very helpful. They understand your problem. They support you. They care about you. And I have like one incident that the doctor was just shouting at me. So I was just really wanted to speak to a doctor. I was feeling like just to so many in a bad way, just to kind of doing something to your life. And I just wanted to speak to a doctor. And then I got an appointment and then went there. And then the doctor was, I don't know what happened to him. And then he was already just, I think he had a bad day or something, was just shouting at me. I was explaining what I'm going through. And he would just, even he couldn't listen to me and then kind of shouting at me. That was my worst experience. And then I was kind of, that day I was kind of crying. So, because I just go to the doctor, just I need some help. And then which I was going through very, very bad. And then I don't know what to do. Then he was just shouting at me without listening. And then that is one experience I will not forget rest of my life, because I really needed the support, because there's no other person that I can explain what I was going through. But it was a very bad experience. So apart from that experience, all the other doctors and nurses and psychiatrists, and then I don't know, even they can't answer some of the questions, you know, like they don't have, they can't solve anything, but they listen to you just in a nice way, and then they encourage you and they motivate you.
Angeliki, just to come back to you, so we've talked about some of the limitations of NHS services and particularly some of the barriers which people from migrant backgrounds face. What kind of impact do you think that these limitations have on the people going through these services?
I think the biggest one is what we already mentioned, is that they might not just get the support that they need, or they might feel very hopeless about the inadequacy of that support, or they might not even be aware that that support exists because of the barriers. And that can mean that mental health difficulties that can be treated like early on and have good outcomes, and like people improve and live meaningful lives, then they mean that they become more chronic and more difficult to treat later on. It can have a really, really huge impact. What we see a lot is that, like, as Kasun's life examples and like what he has told us today about his own journey has shown, is that people can get treatment that is effective and that can then lead them to live very meaningful lives and very productive and fulfilling lives as well. I know that Kasun is doing a lot of brilliant things with his now, and it was really important that he got the support when he needed it, so he could go ahead and be who he is and provides what he can to his community and to himself as well. And the I think the other kind of like sad impact of the hostile environment, let's say in general, is that lots of people who have experienced trauma, they might, and also that they have been exposed to the negative impacts of the hostile environment, they might not feel able to trust government systems in general. So they might not trust NHS professionals, they might not trust social services, because they are perceived to be allied with the government that has, as a system, been perceived by them to be openly hostile to them and their existence in this country. So that can make it very difficult to kind of trust and talk about your difficulties and get the support that you need. And that can be very isolating. So it's what Kasun was saying earlier, is that if I felt that my doctor is the only person that I could talk to, and I was faced with this reaction when I did, like a lot of people in Kasun's place might not try to go to the doctor again, but they might feel very isolated as a result and not get the support that they need.
Okay, great. Well, let's talk about the Helen Bamba Foundation. So Kasun, I'll start with you. In this very complicated, intricate system of mental health care, what is the role of the Helen Bamba Foundation, and what impact does it have?
Thank you. I would say, for me, Helen Bamba Foundation is my home. You know, like when I was asked asylum in the airport, they put me in the jail, and then they transferred me to a detention center. Actually, I was escaping from the jail back home, and then just end up in another jail in the UK. And then Helen Bamba Foundation was the first organization who came to support me, and then just take me out of the detention center. And then from that day, I'm with them. How many years now? About 6 years, 8 years, I think, with them. And then that place is a place that you have friends, and you make friends, and then you have different groups. I go to a group called Photography Group, and then you have all the support there. You have the therapist, my therapist, Angeliki, and then I have housing support there. I have the other all the legal support there, and then you meet. They have all kind of answers for your questions. So if you have some issues, and then you can speak to them, they have the expert at Helen Bamba Foundation. They will kind of help you in all your needs, and then just you start trusting them, you start feeling that you are their family, and then they are your family. And then you have, for example, in our photography group, we don't take photos all the time. We have like different type of food, and then we have about 15 members in the group, and then we have different food, and we start doing something. It's not like a place that you go to a class or something, just you start chatting, and then you just relaxing. And then that's what my doctor, the initial doctor, she referred me when I was explaining how I was going through every day, you know, how my daily life is like, how dark is that? And then she said, why don't Kasun, you go to one of the group, and then see, you don't need to do anything, just to go there, just will help you for at least for some time, that your thoughts and then your memories, to forget those things, and then you try that. And then I went to this group, the photography group. It was really, really different. And then they are all friendly. And then we had food. And then it was kind of at least the time of 1 hour or 2 hour, you forgot your old worries, and then you live with that moment. And then that's what my life started changing. And then I was taking photos and then learning about that, and then and getting more support. And then I go like a symptom management techniques. When you get like PTSD, so there are so many factors that if something triggers you, how you overcome that from that situation, like how you help yourself. And then they train you every single thing, and then when time goes, I start learning my English. And then at one point I thought like, okay, my English was not good, so if I want to live in this country, I need to definitely speak and then write. And then there are so many colleges, they provide free ESOL courses. And then I went there and then I finished my courses. And then eventually I got my application success after 5 years. And then I met Angeliki, and I got the best therapy from her. And then it was really, I want to tell that experience, like kind of give you power, like you go back to your root, the problem caused, and then as like a superhero. And then that person is you. It's like it's in a movie, like, and then that person will help you to comfort you, just make you feel strong and then motivated. Then actually it's a big story. I don't want to take our time, and I'm still using the method when I feel down these days, you know, like. And I want to thank her for Angeliki for that, and then kind of give me kind of lifetime strength, which is me myself to another standing behind me, just tapping on my shoulder that Kasumi, you can do this. Now I'm not a client, now I'm a trainee mentor, I don't know how to say. I'm part of the photography group still, and then I am just helping newcomers to try to help them to teach photography, and then everything where I'm living today because of Helen Baum. So I want to say a big thank you to them, and then big thank you to Angeliki.
That's amazing. You speak really movingly about the Helen Bamber Foundation. Angeliki, I'm going to pass over to you to just tell us a bit about the charity as well.
Well, first of all, I just want to start by thanking you, Kasun, for your kind words, but also say that I want to thank you as well, because I've learned a lot from you. And also, like, it's just been amazing to work with you and see your like incredible resilience and like motivation to overcome the tremendous difficulties that you faced in your life, and see all the growth in you, and like the amazing things that you're doing now. So thank you. And that's why we do what we do. It's just seeing this is something that I do want to pass this message in general for like people who might be suffering from difficulties, but also to professionals who might be hesitant to work with people who have experienced a lot of trauma, is that change happens. It's people like overcome difficulties that they've been through. They might not forget them, but they learn how to kind of live with them. And even in many, many cases, like Kasun's, there is they learn from it and grow as well. So just wanted to point that out. But I think Kasun did a really good job in describing the Helen Bamber Foundation, actually. So there's not too much to add. But I guess it's basically this, what we do kind of like recognize, and what we work with at the Helen Bamber Foundation is with it's that understanding that recovery from this type of trauma of like human rights abuses is very multifaceted. So it that doesn't just require therapy. It requires practical support and emotional safety and like community, a sense of community, a sense of belonging to bring that psychological healing. So actually psychologists and therapists in the Helen Bummer Foundation were a minority. We're not the, there's lots of other excellent practitioners and professionals that we work with. We have caseworkers and housing and welfare team, we have legal protection officers, we have people who work with lots of volunteers and lots of staff that work with the community groups and the different types of activities, like Kasun mentioned, the photography group, and we have doctors as well, GPs that are giving their time to kind of do kind of more holy, more extended assessments of people's physical health needs. And we also have a team dedicated to protect people from risk regarding trafficking, so a counter-trafficking team that supports people around those risks. And working together and working in this kind of like integrated and coordinated way, we find that it's what works best for this population. And that is what I feel that we do differently. And some of those things that we mentioned earlier, that there's like more flexibility in thinking about number of sessions, number of psychological sessions, when people are ready, if there's a good reason to stop therapy and resume it later. So we give more of that flexibility to access therapy at the time that the person is more ready, the person that is more like timely for the person, depending on what's going on in their life in general. So, and that can take a long time. Recovery from trauma can take a long time. And this is usually difficult for like services to kind of cope when you think about capacity and funding, but it's how you need to do things if you want to see people flourishing like Kasun is now.
Well, thank you both. So Angeliki, I know that you're not in Helen Bamber's sort of communications team. Do you know off the top of your head ways that people can support if they want to?
Well, yes, I'm not in that team, but there are, you can access all that information through our website, the HelenBamberFoundation.org. There's like individual contributions, but also other ways that you can support, including volunteering your time. We have actually a tremendous amount of amazing volunteers that are really supporting our work as well.
Brilliant. Okay. And we will share links to helenbamber.org below in the text below the podcast. So do check that out. Well, thank you both so much for coming on today and talking about your experiences. Some of it has been very shocking to hear about, and some of it's been really moving and uplifting. So thank you so much for coming on. Did you want to add anything that we've not covered?
Yeah, I want to say thank you, Luke, for inviting me to this podcast. And then I want to say thank you to Angeliki for helping me to overcome this PTSD and then mental health.
Thank you both as well. And I just want to kind of reiterate that I just like to my fellow mental health practitioners out there in the world that they're, you know, that I think that narrative that like often this population might not be ready or might not engage or might not be able to benefit from interventions is not correct. It's just that we need to adapt the way that we offer interventions to be more culturally competent, really, and meet the needs of this particular population. And also just to share that I find it unbelievable honor and privilege to be able to work with people like Kasun and learn from them and see that amazing resilience. So it's absolutely worth it for professionals, and it's very fulfilling personally as well. So I just wanted to share that.
Wonderful. Well, thank you both so much for your time today. Hopefully speak to you soon and take care.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
You have been listening to Losing Myself, Mental Health in a Hostile Environment. Today's show was brought to you by Migrants Organise, a platform for refugees and migrants to organise for power, dignity and justice to enable meaningful inclusion and integration. They combine advice and support for individuals affected by the hostile environment immigration policy with community organising, advocacy, research and campaigning to dismantle structural racism. The theme song for this episode is Conform or Be Cast Out by Of Moy Om.